This has been a golden age. I know we love to complain, but the last 50 years or so have been extraordinary in the history of higher education. Some of the drivers of the golden age have gone into reverse, and now you are sitting on a high cost base, an operating model that hasn't really had to become much more productive, and the tailwinds are starting to become headwinds.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Education Empowered. I'm your host, Jason Belland, Vice President of Education Cloud Industry Solutions here at Salesforce. I'm so excited to be here with you today. And you know, today, a little bittersweet today. This is our last episode of season five. And you know, I've had such a good time connecting with our guests and connecting with all of you through this season, really exploring topics like flexible learning and work, the faculty and staff experience. We spent a good amount of time talking about well-being as well as digital marketing strategies and a lot more. So it's really just been a rich season with great conversations, all connected back to our Connected Student Report that highlighted top higher ed trends from over 2,000 students and staff from around the world. If you have not had a chance to check that out, I highly recommend taking a look. You can find it at sfdc.co/connected-student-report. So on today's episode, our final episode of the season, I am so honored to introduce you to our amazing guest, Professor Stephen Parker. He is joining us today from Australia. And over the last 30 years, Stephen has held a number of high-profile roles in the Australian education sector, including Vice Chancellor and President of the University of Canberra, Senior Deputy Vice Chancellor and Vice President of Monash University, and Director of Global Development and Strategy at The Conversation. Most recently, Stephen worked as the special advisor at KPMG Australia. And if you read his bio, which I had the pleasure of doing, you will find that Stephen is a music lover and was also the lead guitarist in an undiscovered University of Canberra band, The Hip Replacements. And Stephen, thank you for being here. We want to know all about The Hip Replacements. And this really feels like we've come full circle. On episode one, we started the show by learning that we had two guests on it, and both of them had a musical background, and we started getting excited about, I play guitar myself, so we started getting excited about the education music that we could create together. Tell us what musical inspiration, Stephen. I'd love to hear about The Hip Replacements before we jump in.
Thank you, Jason, and thank you for inviting me. Yes, I had a misspent youth playing guitar in bands, and so I've been playing for decades. And when I became the president of the University of Canberra, we formed a band on campus there called The Hip Replacements, as you say, because we were doing covers and in our own minds, we were hip, even if it wasn't a universally shared view. And so we did blues, pop and rock from Beatles, Stones onwards, up to sort of John Mayer kind of things. And then after I left UC, I've been in other bands, including with a former vice chancellor of the University of Melbourne. So this is what I do.
Oh, this is amazing. Okay, we definitely have to dig into that a little bit later. That's awesome. You know, I play guitar. I have not had the prolific music career that you have, but I play guitar and I really, you know, I'm in New York City. I perform around the city occasionally, but I love kind of accessing a different part of my brain and being creative and kind of just escaping into a totally different space than I use in my day job. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's awesome. Okay. So Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I'd love to kind of just jump in. I'd love to just hear about your career journey. So you've done so much, but how did you get started in education?
Well, as you might hear from my accent, I'm English originally. And I trained as a lawyer, but even when I was practicing as a young lawyer, I wanted to do a PhD, which I then enrolled for, and I mixed legal practice and research and then some tutoring. And then I came to Australia in 1988 and became a full-time academic and scholar. Mm-hmm. Then I guess I rose up through the ranks to full professor. I was Dean of Law at Monash University, which is one of the top law schools in Australia. And then I was lured into the dark arts of management. And as you know, I became president of the University of Canberra. And then I've got to say, I spent a really interesting 4 to 5 years in the private sector afterwards with KPMG in Australia and globally. So I guess it's always been education one way or another, but I've tried to mix it up with connections with other worlds.
That's fantastic. And, you know, I'd love to kind of talk about where we are, where we find ourselves in education today. You know, the pandemic, of course, has had an effect on all of us in so many ways, and particularly our students, faculty, staff, our institutions sort of invited questions about the purpose of education and our role in society. I'd love to get your take. You know, how are you seeing the state of education today? And, you know, and maybe think about what are some of the changes that you've seen over the last couple of years as we've gone through the pandemic that might help us maybe create a little bit of a different future going forward?
A lot of complex issues there. And of course, the pandemic's not over. And
yes,
we don't really know what the long-term effect of it's going to be. But first of all, I'd stress variability. There's been variability between countries. Some of it is accidental. So in Australia's case, our academic year starts in about February. So we went into lockdown just as international students were due to arrive. And in this country, in Australia, there are many students who've not really been on campus for two academic years now.
Mm.
It was different in North America and Europe and so on. So that's one aspect of variability, even within countries. So Australia is a federal system. Some states locked down more readily than others, and that's disrupted universities differentially. And I believe that's the case in other federal systems, including in the USA. So variability, but then variability in the reaction of universities themselves. I think some regarded themselves as invulnerable and they'll just ride it out. And maybe some of them are right as well. And we could come back to issues of invulnerability in higher education. Some thought it would be over soon and didn't do much and then scrambled. Some, and I know this from talking to university presidents, some wanted to get reforms through anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And using the adage, never let a good crisis go to waste, they put changes through.
Sure, yeah.
that they wanted to. Some didn't know, sat on the fence, made some changes, in particular about putting courses online, obviously, but then have come to the view that this is enduring and are now looking at what you and I might call transformation,
mm-hmm.
you know, really rethinking their operating and business model now because they've come to the view, which I largely share, that the world won't be the same again. The next normal will be quite different from the last normal.
Has the, you know, I'm just thinking about those students who never set foot on campus, right? Have their expectations fundamentally shifted at this point and we have to address an entirely different student?
Yes. Basically, there's great disappointment. In Australia and in the UK, they have national student surveys. I'm not so sure in North America. And the 2020 student experience survey in Australia shows a huge drop in satisfaction compared with 2019.
Interesting.
And the UK equivalent, the national student survey, is showing the same. So en masse, students are disappointed with what's happened to them. Some blame their university more than others. Some don't like online learning. Some do, but don't think it's being done very well. You know, and there are some actually where it suits their lifestyle more than it did before. That there were many that weren't actually, they were coming to campus, but they weren't turning up to lectures. They were,
sure.
they were doing other things and they were listening to it online. So differential response, but by and large, student expectations have not been met. And from where I look, where I sit, it's been one of disappointment.
That's super interesting, Steve. And I wonder, you know, if you could comment as well, just, you know, you talked about the students for a minute. What are you seeing on the other side of that, on the faculty side, in terms of rethinking or reimagining how they might deliver academic experiences in the new world?
Well, it's been a slow awakening for some.
Sure.
I think there's many a faculty member who was hoping online would kind of go away, or at least online would be in the sidelines, as it were,
mm-hmm.
and that the centerpiece, the sort of modal way of delivery would still be in person in the lecture theatre. I think many of them are now coming to the view that those days have gone, that there's still a role for the live in-person lecture, but I think they're coming to the view that things have got to be replanned. And going back to the disappointment point, if you've got a course that's been fundamentally designed for face-to-face delivery on campus, and then you just record a whole load of things and make it accessible, that's not really online education.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's sort of mangling one form into another. And I think there's now some real curriculum redesign going on where people are going right back to the basics. What are the learning objectives here?
Mm-hmm.
What's the best way of delivering this material? What material should we deliver? And so they're planning courses for online or hybrid or mixed delivery. And so some of this disappointment should go away, because really good online education, properly supported and supplemented, can be great education. It's just not really happening yet.
And I'd love to kind of talk about, you know, maybe take a little bit of a reflection back on where we've come from. You know, prior to the pandemic, you talked about a number of things coming to a head, including rising university costs. I'd love to kind of just back up for a minute and get your perspective on some of this evolution we've been on over the last several decades, and some of the other, you know, you mentioned changes to how we deliver academic content, but maybe some of the other changes systemically that are in front of us.
Thanks. Yeah, look, I will back up several decades. It's an important starting point, because, and this will surprise many people in universities, but this has been a golden age. I know we love to complain, but the last 50 years or so have been extraordinary in the history of higher education. And the reasons why that it's been extraordinary are also the reasons why disruption is now coming, because nothing can last forever. So if you go back to the end of the Second World War, returning troops, a baby boomer generation in contemplation, and a real determination that the world should be different and better for children being born now. So from the 1950s onwards, expansion of higher education, you know, was clearly a social goal. Then equal opportunity thinking mm-hmm. comes to the fore. And in your country, I think you have equal or civil rights legislation in 1964, 65, something like that. And so higher education to transform people's lives is a strong tailwind for investing in universities and colleges. And then an economist called Gary Becker wrote a book in your country called Human Capital. And the belief really sank in that what is in people's heads is a form of national capital. It's a form of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And so economists started to think, well, actually investing in universities is investing in the economy. So you've got baby boomers, you've got equal opportunity, and you've got human capital theory. And then other tailwinds come along. It's a technological world. People realize we need research. The free market won't produce all of the research that the economy requires. The payback is too long, too uncertain, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So governments around the world started investing in universities to produce research, which some of which would become technology. And then when all of that's sort of hitting its straps, you get huge global change, the growth of middle classes in developing countries, and they want to send their children to universities in the so-called developed world. So you get a huge boom in international students. Australia, proportionately, is the major beneficiary of international students in world history. So all of that combined is actually incredibly heavy time. It's a golden age, but nothing can last. One of the reasons, and you mentioned cost there, one of the reasons is that costs in education are prone to rising. A US economist with a colleague called Bomol came up with the idea of Bomol's cost disease, that there are certain sectors where costs keep on rising. And the reason he gave was that those sectors have to compete with other sectors for wages, but those other sectors can produce productivity gains, whereas education and some others can't produce productivity gains in the same way. So costs keep on being ratcheted up because they're going up elsewhere. Now, that's fine if everyone's prepared to pay for it. And there's a lovely vignette of Beethoven's, I think it's 18th string quartet, where the cost of performing it has risen 23 times in real terms, that's accounting for inflation, since it was first performed. But it still lasts 40 minutes and it still needs four musicians. And so music, performance, education, their costs have to go up because they go up elsewhere. But you can't get away with three musicians in a quartet, or not for long. So so basically then, it's all great as long as people are prepared to pay for it.
Hmm.
But weaving in a feeble rock and roll metaphor, there comes a time when it's roll over Beethoven,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't last. And so what we're seeing in some countries, including your own in the US, but liberal democracies generally, is governments less willing to pay for it, students less willing to pay for it or to incur debt for it. You've got employers starting to wonder, employers saying, oh, I want people to be able to hit the ground running.
Mm-hmm.
Not that any of them could when they started out in life, but there's a questioning going on there. And then there's a questioning about, well, is it all too academic? What about practical, real world?
Sure.
And the taxpayers start saying, well, hang on a minute, I want to invest in defense and social security, healthcare. It's an aging population. So I know I've gone on for a long time, but some of the drivers of the golden age have gone into reverse. And now you are sitting on a high cost base, an operating model that hasn't really had to become much more productive. And the tailwinds are starting to become headwinds.
And you actually, a couple years ago, 2018, you authored a report talking about how do we reimagine education, which included 10 recommendations toward creating a new future for education, including a national tertiary education training program, greater funding transparency and accountability, and a program for appraising teacher performance. Where are we now since you've proposed that?
Yeah. One way or another, quite a lot of what we were recommending is being tried, is beginning. Back up again, and I'm now going back about to about 350 BC, which is a long way back. Aristotle, the philosopher, had a view that there are three kinds of knowledges. There's knowing why, there's knowing how, and there's knowing what to do. And universities have become pretty good at knowing why. They're not so good at knowing how. And a lot of countries have lost the will to train people in how to do things, and apprenticeships have died out and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So what was behind my recommendations in 2018 was a reintegration of knowledge that tertiary, higher vocational education institutions need to mix knowing why with knowing how and knowing what to do. And that's what the world is going to require. And that's what the fourth industrial revolution is going to require. So that was one of the themes. The other theme was student experience. So greater transparency, greater use of data. It is a market. And there's now more supply than there is demand. And so providers are going to have to really get a handle on student experience, know what works for students, know their own type of students much better than they've ever done before. Students can no longer be a nuisance, an interruption of a research agenda. You know, students are it. You neglect your students and you'll go under as a university at some point.
Let's pause on that for a minute, because I think I want to get to kind of talking about business model changes in education. But I think at the center of that is the student and appreciating the whole student and understanding the needs of that student over the course of a lifetime as they probably change careers, et cetera.
Yep.
As you're seeing institutions evolve from, as you said, the student as a nuisance to becoming more student-centric, what are you seeing or what are your thoughts that you might offer to some of our listeners in terms of taking that journey and bringing other people along on that journey and building the technology is only a very small percentage of solving that problem. There are cultural changes, there are organizational changes. So I'd love to just kind of hear your thoughts on when that has worked well, what happens?
Well, story to start. One of the elite universities in Australia, I was talking to their vice chancellor president a few years ago, who said that they like to be reassuringly difficult. They think that when students find it actually hard to change course or enroll, then that reassures them that this must be a prestigious place because it's so difficult to navigate. That university has a new strategic plan where student experience is absolutely front and center. Mm. So there's been a big wake up there that students matter. And one of the reasons for this, by the way, is just it's the age of the customer. And so all kinds of organizations to survive, even governments, have got to be more focused on their key stakeholders. So when a student has their flight cancelled, they get a text to their cell phone, their mobile phone, telling them that their flight's cancelled. But when their lecture's cancelled, they have to turn up and they find a note on the door, sorry, so-and-so is sick today. And it's just not good enough.
Yeah.
So in all kinds of little ways, people's expectations of service have changed. But then focusing specifically on higher education, first of all, lifelong learning. People are going to change careers many times across their lifetime. They're not going to be able to wing it. They're going to have to go back into training. And so they're going to have generic skills. They've got to learn how to learn, know how they personally learn. And so you're seeing universities now focus on people's learning ability and not just on the knowledge that they're supposed to learn in that particular course or degree. So I am seeing a shift there towards preparing people for lifelong learning, as you put it. I don't think the shift's complete and I don't think it's good enough yet, but something is now changing.
As this is happening and as we're seeing, I would love just your perspective on, you know, and you mentioned earlier kind of the kind of skills-based work versus kind of more sort of academic work, English major myself. So appreciate the kind of intersection of kind of academic pursuits with kind of more maybe sort of skills-based, if you will. But as universities are also seeing more competition from kind of very non-traditional providers, you know, I'll call out one, you know, YouTube, right? Or other places where folks can go and get some skills and that's in some ways competing for, in some ways with some students who, you know, may think that is a great path to employment and et cetera. How are you seeing kind of universities pivot or kind of maybe reimagine their business or their business model beyond simply the traditional degree is my kind of core product offering? I need to think about kind of a product mix or different options for these different learners.
Thank you. Well, in terms of product mix, the micro-credential is here to stay. Mm-hmm. It'll be delivered in different ways. Maybe MOOCs have brought it on. And I remember writing that MOOCs could be the Napster moment of higher education in the mm-hmm. same way that Napster, which folded, ushered in music streaming.
Sure.
MOOCs, I think, are ushering in online delivered micro credentials, even if they morph into a different kind of thing. So I think micro credentials are here to stay. Shorter, chunkier pieces of learning, which students can take at their convenience. And you tend to think that's more for the mature age students and not necessarily for the sort of 18 to 22 year old kind of student. But there's a lot of experimentation in modularizing degree courses much more, enabling a kind of almost sort of a mix. Students can mix and match, you know, they put together their sort of Spotify playlist of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So I am seeing that. I am seeing universities probably do what is basic marketing, and that is understand different types of students, building personas, archetypes of different types of students mm-hmm. and asking themselves, do we meet their needs? We meet the needs of this type of student, but do we meet the needs of another kind of student? And if they don't and they can't, they might even stop trying to recruit certain kinds of students in order to provide an excellent student experience for the kind of students that they're going to cater for. And if they don't satisfy all of their students, they're going to get hammered in ratings, rankings, word of mouth, and so on. That's my experience in Australia and the UK, and I think it'll hold in North America too.
Yeah, and I do like this kind of, so many of these things kind of do kind of invite us and institutions to get clear about who is your customer, how are you going to serve that customer, getting clear about what is your mission, what is your purpose, how do you maybe re-energize your purpose toward a certain customer group or community that you're trying to serve. You talked about, I like this idea of the playlist, and wonder if you could just say a little bit more about that. I think it's maybe it's interesting to think about, you know, the student of the future, or the not so distant future, is not only necessarily getting their degree from one university, but is assembling a playlist from a number of different sources that creates something that has some value in society with employers, that requires different kinds of partnerships then with different universities, et cetera. Maybe just talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the starting point is that students themselves know that the degree isn't necessarily the ticket to an affluent life in the way that it has been during what I call the golden age. So students themselves are going to be more discerning and differentiating about institution and the course they're going to do. Students themselves increasingly know their own learning styles. They know what suits them. School education is getting pretty sophisticated around this.
Mm-hmm.
So a university student's going to be arriving at their college, knowing how they learn and looking for learning delivery methods that suit them. And that could include chunking it up into big pieces or into small pieces, self-paced. And then learning analytics are coming along to give real-time feedback to students about how they're going. And it's early days for learning analytics, but when that learning moment becomes clear, that's captured in data. And so every teacher ought to know when the learning moment's going to happen with this type of student in their course, and can start to replan their course or their unit to meet the learning needs and styles of the actual students in their class. This is a completely different approach to getting up there, adopting the Socratic method in the sort of like in the paper chase, you know, terrorizing a group of students in case they're asked the question next. You know, all of that, I think, is just going to fall by the wayside, except as a piece of theater.
So I'm thinking of you in your perspective. You know, you're leading an institution. You're now in your management role, practicing, I think, as you call it, the dark art of, and you're getting faculty excited and everyone, we have a new vision. We're going to do all of these great things. And I'm imagining some folks might be saying, wait a minute, this is not what I signed up for. This entirely changes my role. And that might be a terrifying idea. And so how should leaders at institutions be talking with their faculty and academics on staff about how our roles are going to evolve and the work is going to evolve over time?
Well, I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head, Jason, in terms of a university president standing up there with all these bright, shiny ideas and the faculty members sitting there thinking, yeah, we've heard all of this before. I'm not going to do it.
Uh-huh.
And it's really hard. And, you know, there is, of the many jokes or cliches in university life, one of them is getting change in university is like getting change in a cemetery. You get no help from the inhabitants. And I've experienced that. So, you know, a clever leader does it cleverly, plans it out, knows how much people can take, gives good justifications and evidence for why this has got to happen, has data about what others are doing, you know, persuades people rather than just cajoles people. And I think this is taking a long time. Ironically, the pandemic has been a jolt for people, and that might actually make change more acceptable than it was going to be. But look, it's the full test of leadership. It is explaining the situation. It is motivating people, exciting them about a future, but about a genuine future, not a sort of faux future.
Sure.
Which is in the mind of the president only.
I love that. And, you know, I'd love to kind of maybe, as we're thinking about the future, maybe just to kind of just hear a little bit more from you about, you know, we're working with some, first of all, some amazing institutions in Australia who I think are, you know, frankly, leading the way in terms of lifelong learning and engaging alumni and just doing some incredible work at scale and have done incredible work over the pandemic in working with students in Asia who are unable to travel, et cetera. And a number of schools, of course, in the United States also doing great work in terms of really making sure that, you know, lifelong learning or this conversation about learning over the course of a lifetime isn't something that you get a call about 2 years after you've, you know, graduated and now we're looking for more money to in our grad school or something. You know, it needs to really be carried throughout. And actually, one of our customers who in the United States who manages a career office said to me a couple of years ago, you know, we need to start talking about the career office and career services as something that starts on day one, right? As in the admissions process, not the pamphlet you get on your way out the door about putting your resume together. So, you know, lots of things have changed. You know, just kind of love to hear your perspective on how do we make sure that, you know, there's a lot of talk about lifelong learning, about changing the model, a lot of great work happening. How do we make sure it's kind of pervasive across the student experience so that, you know, from a mindset perspective, everyone's not thinking degree and then I'm done. This is a milestone in my journey and it's okay and it's good and I should be thinking over the course of my lifetime, how do I continue to enrich my skills and credentials?
I think the starting point is student centricity, is that change in mindset that this is not an institution for supplier convenience. This is an institution for the interests of the student. And I don't think all universities have actually made that mental shift yet.
Yeah.
But once you make that shift, that it's all about the student, then you can start to plan things. And you mentioned at scale. I actually think that the future for many institutions is going to be delivering personalized learning at scale. It's got to be personalized. It's got to be learning, but it's got to be at scale because the cost disease that I mentioned is going to mean that the operating model of many institutions is just not affordable. No one's going to pay for it anymore. So we're going to have to be replanning institutions around delivering personalized learning at scale. I fully agree with the idea of careers advice from day one. The technology will permit, CRMs would permit having a sort of case management approach.
Sure.
From the day that the student starts, capturing their changing interests in a career, capturing data about opportunities, getting them work experience through placements, practicums, and so on, and then helping them find that first and then subsequent job. So there are few organizations that would sit on so much information about a young person as a university if they only knew it and could capture it and could then put it to good use. And I think a far-sighted university will really have a profile of a young person who's been with them for 4 years, and that profile can be used and reused across that person's life.
Yeah, I love that. And I love just really recognizing how good we are at universities in higher ed. We're very good at pulling the data in, collecting the data, but kind of making sense of that and taking action. And then evolving this profile over time is probably a growth area that many of us are going through right now. I don't know why I just thought of this, but I keep getting emails from a music vendor that keeps referencing guitar picks that I bought about 10 years ago. And I'm like, you know, my needs have changed from guitar picks 10 years ago to like today. And I think similarly, my career has changed, you know, a lot of things have changed about me, right? And so it's similar to probably the alumni communications that maybe some receive that are kind of referencing something that happened maybe decades ago. And how do we leverage the data in a really great way to essentially really partner with a student over the course of a lifetime?
The institution that I graduated with my first degree from, the University of Newcastle in the northeast of England, which is an elite Russell Group university there, their alumni program has been revived. They're offering their alumni guest lectures online.
Oh, wow.
I can actually now see an expert in their field. It could be urban planning, whatever it is.
That's wonderful.
And they're offering specific lectures designed just to cater for the interests of people. Now, I don't see why, given online technology, given the capacity that they can be played and replayed repeatedly by an infinite number of people, I don't know why universities aren't doing more to engage intellectually with their alumni, rather than just going back to the good old days. You know, and as you say, people might have moved on from some of it. Maybe they don't drink alcohol anymore, whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's some of the thing that kind of is exciting for me is seeing globally many universities doing exactly that and kind of reimagining their alumni engagement and really thinking about themselves as providing content and partnership and thought leadership with their amazing graduates and bringing them back in different ways. So I'd love to maybe land on, you know, I should talk about technology for a minute here, given it's a Salesforce podcast.
Sure.
And you've talked about so many things that, you know, we've talked about being able to do things at scale, but I'd just love to know, just from your perspective, you know, what are some of the things that in terms of technology that you're excited about that are going to help us get to this future?
I'm excited about technologies which can be used by or within a university, but I'm also about technologies out there in the world that universities are going to have to help students get ready for.
Oh, yeah.
Within the university, I mean, I think it's very early days in learning analytics, but as I said, there's a lot more that can be captured about a young person and their learning and why they're learning. And then it can be visualized in a way that an instructor, a teacher can make almost immediate use of. I think online learning, which is responsive to students' cues, that they change the pace, mm-hmm. they maybe even change the content, I think that's really interesting. I think the teacher will be decentered in favor of a team that supports students' learning, and technology will be a key part of that. Then in the campus experience, there's Internet of Things. I know a lot of people are turning into smart campuses. So there's plenty within a university. And also, the way a university runs itself can benefit much more from technology. I think mine is a minority view, but I don't actually know why you need faculties anymore. You do need disciplines. You do need people that identify with an area of knowledge and a methodology for discovering. But these large chunks where cost aggregates and frankly resistance builds up as well, I don't think you need that. And I think with the technologies available now, you could have a strategic senior management. You could remove a lot of middle management, and you could relate directly to faculty and academic managers, faculty and academic staff members. So I actually think the whole internal structure of a university could be transformed for the better by technology. But then looking at the world out there, I'm a big believer that the fourth industrial revolution is going to be as big, if not bigger, than any previous technological revolution. Machine learning, if I had to focus on one, the capacity for artificial intelligence to get better and better and learn from itself is going to be amazing. And so the search is on for, well, what's the human competitive advantage? What can we do that in due course an algorithm isn't going to be able to do? And I think you'll find it in true creativity. You might find it in dexterity. Ask a robot to pick up a glass of water and they're pretty useless at it. And, you know, it's going to be a long time before robots can do dexterous things. So thinking ahead there about capturing people's creativity, their genius for innovation, I think, and also for doing the practical, making the world a better place with their hands, I think that's where human beings are going to fit in the coming world. And so education's got to plan for this. It's got to help people unleash their creativity, know what they're good at, keep them thinking that anything is possible. And in addition, obviously, prepare people for technology. So I imagine that the information sciences and engineering are going to boom. But you, I think you said you're an English literature major.
That's right.
I think people in creative writing and understanding human flourishing, I think they'll be at a premium too. Some of the professions that may find it more difficult are the elites, the lawyers. We're going to need as many lawyers when an algorithm can draft a better document and give a better prediction of success in a dispute. And there is one study coming out of the University of Oxford that indicates that surgery could be automated away within 50 years' time. That actually, no doubt with human involvement somewhere, but not necessarily in the theatre, that robotics are going to be more accurate and so on. Now, yeah, that's probably going to be after my time, and I'm relieved about that. But But the predictions that are being made in professions about the capacity of automation and robotics are just extraordinary. And so this University of Oxford study indicates that in about 100 years' time, all human labour as we know it could have been automated. We've got to start preparing people for a world that might come like that.
Yeah. Stephen, this has given us so much to think about. Thank you. I definitely do not want to be first on the operating table with the... but that's incredible to think about that in the future. And really the opportunity for us to all kind of imagine what is our role in that future and how do we create that. So much inspiration, Stephen. Some good humor throughout, and I do want to thank you. We're really grateful that you were able to take the time to be with us today. Thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome. Be careful out there.
Thank you, and to everyone listening, thank you so much. We're so grateful that you spent a couple of episodes with us this season, and hopefully you'll have a chance to check out some of the other conversations we've had in some of our previous seasons. It's been great to be with you. We're so grateful that you've taken the time to be with us and to invest in yourself, as well as your students, your institutions, and the communities that you serve. Thank you so much for being with us. Take care, everyone. Be well.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Education Empowered. If you enjoy this episode and want to explore these topics in greater detail, be sure to check out the second edition of Salesforce's Connected Student Report. The survey includes insights from more than 2,000 students and staff across 10 countries about students and staff well-being, career readiness, flexible learning options, and so much more. You can find the report at sfdc.co/connectedstudentreport. That's sfdc.co/connectedstudentreport.